from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back, dear listeners. First things first, as we record, you know, as I told you all before, we record this podcast about a week before you all actually hear it. And so today in Louisville, it is Wednesday, September 23rd, as we record this first interview and start the show. And Attorney General of the State of Kentucky, Daniel Cameron, has just announced the results of his investigation into the killing of Breonna Taylor many, many months ago. And there's been the results of the grand jury indictment. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about that in today's show. Like this literally all just happened in the last half an hour. So details are still forthcoming. And of course, we want to bring you all an entire episode soon of reactions and thoughts, you know, but we have to acknowledge that that is what went down today. Nonetheless, we still have some wonderful interviews that we'd already had planned that we're going to bring you today. But I want to acknowledge that came out today. We're going to mention it at the end of the show. But in the meantime, Doc, I want to talk about our first guest. I'm super excited about our first guest because it's a topic I've been thinking about a lot lately. And the topic, by the way, is adoption, okay? And adoption of particularly of when Black folk adopt Black children or single parents adopt Black children, single Black parents adopt Black children. And of course, you know, my other best friend, Tori, who lives in Baltimore, Charlie's been going through a doc because he really wants to adopt. He's been thinking about adoption for the last several years. He's fostered almost a dozen children, half a dozen children, who all ultimately gone back to biological families. And he, you know, he had one potential adoption that didn't quite work out. And so he's really, really going through it. And you know, we talk about it every day about he is a 40-year-old gay man and just, and his, you know, he's frankly talking about, he shared his article with me, Doc, about, you know, women have this alleged biological clock and this alleged innate desire to parent. But what about men? And what about when men also have that same desire? And what about the loss that men experience when they're unable to have children for whatever reason, right? So Tori's currently going through that. So this story actually is a success story that I can't wait to share with Tori about a single Black woman who decided that she wanted to adopt a Black child of her own. And so to tell us more about that, but also to talk about the problems when it comes to Black folk, especially Black single folk adopting Black children, we're going to get into that as well. So please welcome to the show, author Nefertiti Austin. Nefertiti, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, there's so much we want to talk with you about today. You wrote a really wonderful piece for the New York Times. So I want to start there, first of all, because, of course, there's the issue of adoption. But long before many of us have experiences with adoption, or maybe we don't know someone who's adopted, we all have play cousins. We all, you know, got a grandmother we live with for a summer. Or perhaps, you know, a mother's best friend's child came to live with us for college. So this notion of play families and extended families and the role they play in Black communities, you wrote a wonderful piece for the New York Times called Grandparents, Kin, yes, and Play Cousins, The Soul and Survival of Black Families. And talk to us a little bit about that piece and what you seek to, the concepts that you seek to address to folk who may be unfamiliar with how Black folk operate when it comes to extended families.
So I wrote that piece because I've been trying to push the envelope within adoption because most of the resources and information are really geared towards white people who adopt children of color. And I wanted to explain why our numbers on paper are less than white people when it comes to formal adoption. And so, you know, I've been told, well, you know, Black people don't adopt. And of course, that's a myth because we do adopt. But typically when we adopt internally. We start with family members. We start with, you know, your immediate family. And then we kind of expand out, you know, cousins and then folks in the neighborhood, people, church, you know, whatever and whomever are within our midst whom we consider family. And that's a very different dynamic than the ways in which white people approach the creation of their families. And so I wanted to really show that we, just like, you know, white people in other groups, you know, love the people in our family. We are not interested in losing our children or giving them away to the system. That's another myth. And we just create family really from an ancestral point of view, meaning that it's we're far more communal. We're still very communal, you know, after being in this country 450 plus years. And Black adoption, informal adoption is very real for us. And those ties that we create in our informal creation of family are just as important and just as binding as going the formal route. So that was really the impetus for the article.
Yes, and I really, really loved this article, Nefertiti, because you, and you just kind of briefly mentioned the ancestral connection that Black Americans have toward kinship ties and non-blood ties. Talk to our listeners a bit about your referencing in your piece of talking about how communal living, folks and children in Black and African communities being raised with huge families, mothers, aunts, grandmothers, so on and so forth. How does this kind of practice and kinship practice start on the African continent, and how have African Americans continued this tradition now?
Well, definitely what the ancestors knew and what we know is that we are definitely stronger when we are a unit. And so it's really this idea of everyone coming together for the greater good. So we're so much stronger when we function as a whole. And I think, you know, and then with enslavement, being torn from our ancestral home and brought to this country, and the infrastructure of slavery having no regard for our family ties, we created family. And so when mothers and fathers were separated from each other, the children were separated and sold to different farms and plantations and things, there were still a lot of orphans. And those children needed support, they needed love, they needed to be taken care of. And I just think it's something that's in our DNA, something that we continue to practice, because whether or not you are biologically connected to someone, I think in our community, we still want each other to feel loved and a part of something.
Absolutely. I was surprised, Nefertiti, by a part of your article that pointed out that only 13% of formally adopted Black children, 13% of formally adopted children live with a Black parent. And so how common is this kind of informal system, or even when it's formalized, of living with either a blood relative or living with someone that is chosen family? How common of a practice is that? Are more children who are, for lack of a better term, parentless, in terms of not being able to their biological parents, are mostly living with folk who are chosen? And then furthermore, what are the benefits of kinship adoption or kinship fostering?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the kids are with a relative, usually it's grandma. And sometimes it's another, you know, a different family member. And definitely the benefits of keeping a child within his or her community family unit is less stress on the children. So one of the complaints about children in the system is that they are bad. They are, you know, nobody wanted them. They're the lowest of the lowest, the dregs of society. But often those children are under a tremendous amount of stress. So even in the best homes, when a child is not with their biological parents, they have still experienced loss and trauma, and it comes up some kind of way at some point throughout their life. And so you can minimize the stress, you minimize depression, you minimize drama, you minimize delays educationally, maybe behaviorally, when a child can remain connected with their family members. It isn't always possible. Like in my kids' case, it wasn't feasible. So they had to be adopted away from their families. But whenever possible, it cuts down on so much. And I think it gives the kids a much smoother transition into their teenage years, adult years, and so on.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about, and to give our audience just a brief kind of synopsis, because I love the way you present it in your piece in this very concise and succinct way, about the differences of how African Americans using ancestral knowledge of community and non-blood ties and being in the United States, how your grandparents were Southern transplants who lived with relatives in LA, but how white families and the construction of this idea of a white nuclear family is different. So how are those two conceptions differently interpreted within white households versus black households, and what that has to do with the history of our country and specifically black Americans coming here through enslavement and many white Americans coming here with their own free will and immigration?
Okay, I'm gonna try to break all of that down.
But you do it in such a concise way. I love it. It's
perfect. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so certainly when white immigrants were coming to the United States, I mean, they certainly, you know, majority of them came through Ellis Island, others came from other places. And so initially, most groups lived in multi-generational households. But after a couple of generations, when Irish and Polish and Italians and other groups sort of shed some of their ethnic identity, it became less important and they were able to assimilate into mainstream culture. They were just considered white and American. They were able to move forward economically, politically, family-wise, and that sort of thing. And so there was no need to rely upon a grandparent or parents to help them get their own place, help them get established. And so the establishment of the nuclear family is really a 20th century construct, like mid 20th century. And so American society, mainstream society declared, okay, this is what it looks like. It's a mother, a father, you know, 2.2 kids and pets. And so this is another social construct. And anyone outside of this particular construct, you know, something's wrong with you, something's wrong with your dynamic. Somewhere along the way, there was a failure to thrive. And that is ignoring enslavement and ignoring segregation, mass incarceration, and all of the things that lead to the breakdown of families of color, Black families in particular. And so other people have said that our family configurations are problematic. And so they don't count us in the same way that they count white families, but we are very comfortable with this is the ways in which we create family, and we're going to continue that way because that's just who we are. So I hope I hit all of the points in your question. I'm not sure.
No, you did. I mean, it was absolutely perfect. Thank you so much. I'm sorry for long loaded.
That's okay.
That was important. That was cool for me to kind of to juxtapose, you know, the ways in which we are, how to juxtapose how we became who we become in terms of, as a lot of European immigrants, you know, kind of became white, you know, their idea, yes, of what, you know, their idea of what family, and that's still to this day. I mean, there's the old pun about like white folks, their parents, get, oh, they ship them to a nursing home, right? But Black folks, they're not single parents in a nursing home.
Right.
there's a history to that, and I appreciate you breaking that down. I want to transition now a bit more to your personal story.
You wrote
a book that's cleverly titled, I'm sure it's amusing, but it's called Motherhood So White. And in this book, well, first of all, you write this book because, as I mentioned before, you're a single Black woman, you're ready to get you some children, and so you go looking for resources, right? You don't find much.
Right.
So take it away.
Right. So I'm ready. I'm ready to become a mother. I was less pressed about being married. Wanted to be, but that was less of an issue for me at the time. I really wanted to be a mother. I really wanted to adopt it. And I wanted a little Black boy, a Black baby boy. And I get started because I'm such a nerd, love to read, looking for resources. And I can't find anything. There are a couple of blogs here and there, anecdotal stories here and there. But there are no books in the parenting aisle with or about four women who look like me. And I know I'm not the first single Black woman to want to adopt or to adopt. And I felt like, okay, this is ridiculous. And so my early writings were really me raging against publishing and just how segregated it was and it is, and the parenting genre, and how is it, given the relationship between Black women and white children in this country, that there are like no books written by Black women on motherhood and on parenting. And so I was told quite quickly that our stories are marginal, and that while what I had to say was important, essentially no one's going to read it. The book won't sell. You know, no publisher is going to buy it because my experience is marginal, and it's marginal because I'm Black and I'm writing from a point of view of being a Black mother. So that is the source for the title and how I ended up on this path of writing about race and adoption and parenting and motherhood.
I can't wait. I can't wait to read your book. I'm so excited about it. And it's so necessary, so timely and important. And I wanted to talk about something else that you mentioned, though, in your New York Times piece, when you talk about multi-generational households and how now when it comes to the opioid crisis, for instance, that's affecting many white households adversely, how federal and state child welfare agencies have stepped in with financial assistance, education, parenting classes, so on and so forth to help this new term, what is called grand families. And you talk about how when you were a kid, you wish that those resources were around when Black communities were adversely affected through drugs. How do institutions help to hold up and further perpetuate and isolate the crisis of family when it comes to that of Black families and white families? Why are these federal agencies and child welfare agencies stepping up to respond to the opioid crisis and white grandparents adopting children, whereas they did not do this for Black families?
Well, as long as it was poor people, you know, including poor whites who were addicted and dying and going to jail for drug trafficking, possession, that sort of thing, you know, nobody cared. As long as Black men and women were on the other end, on the receiving end of a mandatory minimum sentence for, you know, crack, nobody cared. But as soon as these addictions, suicides, accidental suicides because of opioids started hitting the suburbs, and suddenly it became a crisis. And so in my research, what I found is that grand families is not necessarily a new term, but it's become a far more popular term. And the way the sort of spin on why suddenly there's funding to assist families is largely because white people are being middle class and rich and beautiful, and famous people are being directly negatively impacted by the opioid crisis, that money is suddenly finding its way, it's trickling down to other people. I mean, we really, Black people have only truly been free and truly usefully, you know, I'm using that term loosely, since the 60s. So that's not really a long time. And on paper, we're still very much seen as second class citizens. So when I was growing up, and my grandparents raised my brother and I, you know, there were no laws. There's nobody checking for us. So fortunately, they had the means, they had the time, and they were able to do it. But a lot of people weren't necessarily in the same position that my grandparents were. And, you know, it made it hard, but we come together and we do what we have to do. So I'm happy at least money is going to families. I just wish that this whole grand family thing didn't mean that the children had to go into the system in order for the families to qualify for services or on the verge of going into the system. So that's another piece that needs to be figured out.
I love it. Well, before we let you go, I want to go back to the book again real fast. And again, that book came out in 2019. Make sure you all grab your copies. You mentioned that part of your writing this book, it was partly a part memoir, talking about your own experiences, but you also wanted to dispel certain myths. You wanted to fight back against certain stereotypes of single Black motherhood, but then you also wanted to confront realities of what it means to raise children of color, particularly Black children, in the racial tribes of America. So you have your son, you were very intentional about adopting a Black boy because you saw them as the throwaway to society. Eventually you got a daughter as well. So maybe you've
been thinking about
her as well. But talk a bit briefly, if you will, about some of those stereotypes of Black single motherhood. And then also, what does it mean to be raising a Black boy and furthermore, a Black daughter in today's racially charged society?
So, yeah, some of the obvious myths are that a single Black mother is a woman who is poor or maybe uneducated. There's no man in sight, and she's just perpetuating a vicious cycle. And so for white women, whether it's intentionally being a single mother or oops pregnancy, that sort of thing, that is very much seen as badass. That's their word. And that's just like, oh, wow, she's so strong. She's so this, you know, she deserves to be applauded for making such a choice. But for Black women, it's expected that we are loose with our bodies, no respect for ourselves. And therefore, you know, well, of course, she's a single mother. And so that certainly is not the case. And in our country, so many families, so many children are being raised by single mothers. So we definitely know that that's not true. But Black mothers are still painted with that brush. In addition to the welfare queen, you know, she's always a Black woman who's trying to get over on the system. You know, thank you, Ronald Reagan. But it's white people who make up the majority of the recipients on welfare. But, you know, that always gets lost somewhere in the fine print. Now, what is it like to raise Black children in a racially charged country? It's challenging. I mean, all of the stuff that has happened from Ahmaud Arbery, you know, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Jacob Blake, you know, all of these things that are happening regularly, it is exhausting and it's painful to have to constantly go back to my now 13-year-old son and say, oh, this happened this week. Okay, this happened last week. Okay, well, yeah, you know, tomorrow that's probably going to happen to someone else, and not undermine or kill his spirit, because I want him to be happy and I want him to thrive. I want him to be aware. But I hate that it's constant, that it's Black men primarily who are being abused, killed by police. Now, we definitely know it happens to Black women, and I talked to both of my kids about that as well. And with my daughter, it's a little bit different because she's younger. And so it's more of a conversation on about her self-esteem and making sure she understands that her brown skin, you know, her curly hair that gets tangled when I'm trying to comb it is beautiful. And she should be so proud to have so much hair on her head that her mom can't comb. Like, this is a blessing. This is good stuff. And how smart she is, and to really focus on the gifts that she has been blessed with and what she can give to the world. So I feel like I'm always on and being on top of protecting their self-esteem. And so wherever we go, whether it's school or if we're out in the world, you know, I just make sure that I arm them with the truth of who they are, the truth about how strong their ancestors are. And but for them, we wouldn't be here. And that's a good thing.
Right on, right on. Listeners, our guest today has been Nefertiti. Austin Nefertiti is a writer, adoptive mother, and the author of Motherhood So White, which is available wherever you get your books. Hey, Nefertiti, you have taught me so much. And again, as I say, this is a topic it's been on my mind a lot lately. And I'm going to share with my other best friend, Tori, just how inspirational your story is. And that he should not give up hope that there's a child out there for him. And adoption
absolutely
is the way to go. So thank you so much. And please take care.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, your friend will get his child or children. It'll be great.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Petey, bye-bye.
The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh.
Or made you think.
We hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate.strangefruitpod.org. Thank you.
All right. So many thanks to Nefertiti for that wonderful conversation about Black parenthood. So Daka, they all have a real life hot topic. So just this week is what they call Pub Day. You know, I learned some industry lingo. I guess Pub Day is the day in which a published author has their book hit the presses. And so there's a really exciting new book, y'all, that has its roots in Louisville. This book is a book of poetry, and it's the winner of the Donald Hall Prize for Poetry. Now, apparently, that's a really big deal. In fact, this book was selected by a former U.S. Poet Laureate, and the actual author of this book of poetry is actually from Louisville. So without further ado, welcome to the show, award-winning poet Joy Priest. Joy, how are you?
Hi, I'm so happy to be on the show. I'm very familiar with it, of course, it being...
Aww. Well, thank you.
I guess I should have you.
Hey, do I say happy pub day? Is that proper legal, happy pub day?
Yeah, happy pub day, happy release day. Yeah.
All right. Phenomenal. So listen, you have written this book of poetry called Horsepower. Horsepower is your debut collection. And it's supposed to tell the story of a daughter's waywardness, and it's also an aspirational story. And it even talks about your childhood as, if I'm not mistaken, as a biracial, this is the one I remember from the pitch, of a biracial child in Kentucky whose granddaddy was racist as hell. Is that part of it?
Yeah, so there's like a industry popular understanding of poetry collections, and then there's like, you know, the poet's understanding. And so we usually like separate the poet from the poems that they write, so that it's not like necessarily autobiographical to the T, because, you know, we like to invent details and things like that. But it is based on my experiences growing up in Louisville.
I love it. Yeah, what Audre Lorde called it is like a biomythography. I learned that from Dr. Story.
Yeah.
And I imagine when I think of and I tell story about my own childhood, of course, parts of it are true, but then parts of it are imagined either on purpose or accidentally, right? Like when I think back about a situation that happened when I was six, when I remember it this way, that may or may not have been how it actually went down. So the notion of a biomythography, yeah, so it's not the literal telling of your story, but certainly it found inspirations of some of your experiences. Joy, what in your own words is Horsepower about? What kind of issues do you take on? What kind of stories do you seek to tell? And what led you to write this particular collection?
Right, well, I'm really glad you used the word biomythography, because I actually consider myself a poet in the tradition of, you know, latter 20th century Black feminist politics, out of which a certain tradition of poetics comes, right? And that is part of that is biomythologies. But I consider this collection to be, since we're talking about genres, really a kind of like more of a cinematic narrative across the poems. And a lot of the themes that it's dealing with is that this speaker, who of course is based on my life, who I named Sparkle in the book, in the second poem, is a child growing up outside, right across the street from Churchill Downs, which is our world famous horse racing track, as you know. And this is true of my life also, but I really used the horse as a motif throughout the book to talk about other things, like to activate certain other themes in Black literature, like Zora Neale Hurston's, we know her famous quote, that the Negro woman is the mule of the world. And so I used the equine, the equus, to address those sort of things. I also was thinking about Louisville specifically, and specifically like race and working class Louisville, and this tradition of you know, cars, the old school, stasis and mobilization and these sort of different things around the term horsepower.
I love it. And I just cannot wait to read this. I love how your poetry goes into the interiority of your life, as well as connected to like larger social phenomenon, which so reminds me of Lorde's poetry. And so many people they love Lorde's prose and not so much, you know, her verse and her poetry, but it just said to me, it mirrors that tradition of intersecting one's own life with these larger phenomenological conclusions. And so you are also, at the same time that you wrote this book, you're also a doctoral student in literature and creative writing at the University of Houston. How and what is your writing process like, Joy? So for our listeners, that is a lot to take on, being a current doctoral student, writing a great award-winning volume of poetry. How are you doing all these things at the same time?
Yeah, it's a lot. I'm a Capricorn Virgo, so.
Yes, Capricorn.
I'm very organized and ambitious, but I like really claim that interstitial space between a scholar and poet. And, you know, as you mentioned, Audre Lorde, which I mean, I'm beyond flattered with that connection. But, you know, a lot of the poets that I feel that I'm in lineage with, like Nikki Finney, who's my teacher and mentor, like June Jordan, like Audre Lorde, weren't just poets in the sense that they wrote poems. They were writers. They were, they commented on, you know, our social conditions. And that often took the form of poetry, but it also took the form of study and scholarship. So I actually just, you know, used Lorde in my class on early American poetics the other day, because we're reading about these like old white dead Puritan poets. And a lot of the sort of rhetorical argument in poetry came from them. And so I was talking about Audre Lorde's poem Power, where in the opening, and I'm not gonna be able to quote it exactly, I should, but he talks about the difference between poetry and argument as being the difference between willing to kill yourself or your children. And so I'm always constantly thinking about, I'm not just a poet after beauty, I'm a poet to tell the truth about what's happening in the world. And scholarship is definitely an inquiry, a study into that.
Yes, yes, I love it. I love it. When you were answering, my mic was muted, but I'm like, yes, yes. and so as Jay had mentioned before and asked you before, like you talk about growing up as a biracial child, dealing with this kind of white supremacist grandfather and relative, living by Churchill Downs, which is known, of course, for the Kentucky Derby and so on and so forth. And then I think that your description of Louisville is also so robust and three-dimensional, how it's both urban and southern, and at the same time, it's also working class. So how were you as a child and growing up having to navigate all these spaces, having to deal with and unlearn the white supremacy as it was propagated by your relative, to come into a sense of empowerment around your Blackness and heritage, and then also what growing up in Louisville was like navigating that southern, urban, derby, all those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in my personal life, I actually, the large turn of the story is like this idea of being a non-self-identified child to being a self-identified adult. And so I actually, in my adult life, do not identify as biracial, I identify as Black. And it really was, personally, it really was, I grew up, you know, for the first, 8 years of my life in my grandfather's house, off of Longfield Avenue on the back side of the racetrack, the stable side. But as soon as I met my father, around this age, I immediately joined his household, and he was living on and off Algonquin Parkway at the time. So I went from sort of this South Louisville working class environment to this West Louisville Black community. And I grew up in a Black church, and I went to Central High School. So I think that I was fortunate in that sense that a lot of Black people with one white parent don't always get that, that fortune to then, you know, sort of come up in Black spaces, which I think is really important for identity. So that later on, when white people are giving you problems, you're just unconcerned because you validate your sense of self with Black things and Black people and Black values. So I was very fortunate in that sense to have that transition at an early age in my personal life. I don't know if I answered all of the question. But those locations around Louisville are sort of like a map of that racial transition, I guess. And I was just listening to y'all's podcast from Tuesday about transracial adoption. And I'm actually sort of writing about that right now and studying that right now, because what I've discovered after writing this book is that I think I'm really concerned about the experience of a Black child having a white parent and the dangers of that. And how a white parent can be dangerous to their children, and how fortunate I was to be able to transition into these Black spaces as a child.
I love it, Joyce. I wonder, before we let you go, if you would be willing, there were two pieces in particular that stood out to me, and if you'd be willing to share those with our listeners. to do a bit of a reading. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
So I'll let you pick which one you want to read. Or you can do both even if you want. One, of course, is ABC Darien for Alzheimer's. And then I also loved No Country for Black Boys. Is there one of those, or perhaps both of those, that you care to share with our audience?
I can read both of those. I can also read the title poem and one of those.
You read as many as you do what you like. If yes, please. Okay. So what we're doing, I'm going to restate that. I'm going to invite you to read some poetry with us. You tell me what you want to read, okay?
Okay, I'll read the title poems and then the two that you said, if that's okay.
So I wonder, Joy, before we let you go, if you'd be willing to read, some of your piece with us and our listeners. I mean, I've loved several poems. I have my personal favorites, but I wonder if you'll share perhaps the title piece and some other pieces with us, our listeners.
Sure, I'd be excited to do so. So this first poem is called Horsepower, and it's the title poem of the book. Off season, before the racetrack opens, I jump through the threshold of my back door stable side. A dove takes off from its nest tucked into the corner of the porch awning, glides through my world, which I can see in its entirety from my top step. The twin steeples and emerald roofs just past our garage, a horse practicing its start out of the gate. Only Longfield, that avenue rounding the perimeter of the pill-shaped track, where the red and white and green flags ripple from balconies, and my neighbors sell horchata in styrofoam cups, street tacos in paper baskets with cilantro and lime. Only Longfield and a chain link fence separates the horse's air from mine. They work the loop of that circular mile, making everyone's living except their own, the motors of our economy. Beyond the spires is a larger world I do not know exists. A mile west in my line of vision is a family I do not know I have. In that corner of the city, separating from the land like a cell in mitosis, straining across the Ohio River to the north, my great aunt, black matriarch, rocks on her blue porch, and my father, just a couple of blocks away from her, coos my baby brother into sleep, while his new wife flowers the wings of a flightless bird. But all I know for now is my grandfather, the white one. And I know my mother, who I can hear now roaring home from work in her muscle car. And wait, I know the horses and their restless minds. Absidarian for Alzheimer's. An absidarian is a form of a poem where the beginning of each line is the successive letters of the alphabet, so A, B, C, D, and so forth, all the way down to Z. Angel was my papa's girlfriend when he died. Back there in my memory, I hear my mother fussing about condoms. And AIDS, she is saying, the girl is only 25 and black. My daddy, amused at the irony of racism, whispering to me, he's at his end anyway. Angel was stripping at Deja Vu when he moved her into the front bedroom. And this is where I began to realize what precisely was going on. He couldn't remember me, but by then he was forgetting who he was too. Outside the club next to our world famous horse racing track, the infamous sign read, Win Play Show Bar, 99 pretty girls and one ugly one. A jab at Angel, their only dark-skinned dancer. She mystified them with her kaleidoscope of color contacts and quick weaves. They loved her equine legs. I loved her for telling my secret loud, for making a messy joke of him and my mother the way I felt they had made a mess of me. After Angel moved in, I never saw him again. My mother avoided his street. She could not get over the hypocrisy, how he disowned her when I was born, then made her promise not to speak of my blackness, my father, to me. Buried whole of quiet lies they dug for years before it opened beneath the two of us and ruined everything. Maybe my mother envied Angel because she saw the truth of him out. And when he began forgetting to hate us, to put his white hood on every day, Angel used him the proper way. I like to think of her as Veritas, the goddess at the bottom of that empty well, naked and holding a hand mirror. Or maybe it was me, a xeric unblooming thing down there beneath them. I had, for years, been taught to live that way. Black, unassuming, zipped up in history, a disease not even progress can cure. This next poem is No Country for Black Boys, and it's a contrapuntal. It's a form in which you get two voices that then can be read together. So I'll read down the left column. You'll hear me read down the right column, and then I'll read across both columns. No Country for Black Boys. When walking while black from a 7-Eleven, conceal your watermelon Arizona fruit juice. No sudden movements like, say, reaching for a pack of Skittles. You might end up wrestling for the right to live. You be second-class citizen unarmed, 3 weeks 17. Fight, howl for help in your home, heart suspended over a hollow point. Remember to call out a mother's name. They don't know your screams apart from man with gun. He is the one who survives in America. I am always there. I patrol, I follow, dark skin in a hoodie. I leave my vehicle, come after you, trying to get away. I neighborhood watch. Like a suburb with color rushing in, your life has low value, boy. Parade around here like that, like you are only victim. Plead for help in your savage life. Get trial and conviction on my Florida sidewalk. Remember me, pain. Die with only a ghetto heart. How does it feel listening to your body expire? These assholes always get away, but I am the one who survives in America. When walking while black, I am always there. I patrol, I follow. From a 7-Eleven, conceal your dark skin in a hoodie. Watermelon, Arizona fruit juice, I leave my vehicle, come after you. No sudden movements like, say, trying to get away, I neighborhood watch. Reaching for a pack of Skittles like a suburb with color rushing in. You might end up wrestling for your life has low value, boy. The right to live, you parade around here, be second-class citizen unarmed like that, like you are only 3 weeks 17. Fight, howl, victim, plead for help in your home, heart, savage life. Get trial and conviction suspended over a hollow point on my Florida sidewalk. Remember me, remember to call out a mother's pain, die with only a ghetto name. They don't know heart. How does it feel listening to your screams apart from your body expire? These assholes, man with gun, he is the one who always get away. But I am the one who survives in America.
Listeners, our guest for this segment has been poet Joy Priest. The book is Horsepower. It's the winner of the Donald Hall Prize for Poetry. And I'm proud to say that Joy Priest is right here in my city of Louisville, Kentucky. Joy, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for telling your story to us, for sharing your wonderful work with us, and for sharing three wonderful pieces, y'all. This is Joy's Pub Week. Go wherever to your favorite, go to your favorite. Y'all, the book comes out this week. This is Joy's Pub Week. Get the book Horsepower wherever you get your books, online, your favorite local bookstore, wherever. And Joy, thanks so much for being with us. We wish you the best of luck. Come back anytime.
Thank you so much. I was so happy to do this podcast. I love y'all.
I love you too, Joy. Thank you so much for sharing your powerful work with us. Thank you.
Thanks to both of our wonderful guests, Nefertiti and Joy, for two phenomenal conversations.
Yes, I really enjoyed the show this week.
Yeah, Joy's poetry was awesome. And of course, you know, child, you know I love all things Louisville. So anybody
from
Louisville, I'm going to brag upon it, you know, for the most part. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, Doc, we would be remiss to not acknowledge the verdict that came out today. With mere minutes before we began recording today's episode. So it, of course, threw us for a loop. But as I promise you all, listeners, we're going to bring you all a bit more coverage of the issue once we have a chance to get our bearings about ourselves. You know, there's some wonderful reporters from Louisville Public Media and the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting that have been covering this story for many months. We're going to see who we can get to come to the show and break down for us, but I will just report the bit that I know, that is that today, which is Wednesday, September 23rd, the grand jury indicted Officer Brett Hankinson, He was one of three officers who was involved in the shooting that night at Breonna Taylor's apartment. The hope by many activists and the family of Breonna Taylor was that all three officers involved would be fired and indicted. However, after a months-long investigation by not only the FBI, not only the Louisville Police Department, but also the Attorney General, the ultimate decision was made to indict Brett Hankinson, and he was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment. They are all three Class D felonies, and they are all related to, quote, extreme indifference to human life, because he fired his gun into the apartment, and he was a warrant was issued for his arrest, and a cash bond was set at $15,000. Each charge carries up to 5 years in prison, and that's all we have so far. The other two officers were not indicted, and so that's what we have, Doc. I'll give you the final word, Doc, if you have any initial commentary. You know, of course, this is still breaking news. We're going to go tune in and find out more information, and of course, we're going to bring more in-depth coverage. But Doc, I'll give you the final word on what's happened today.
Yeah, so, you know, I was watching it before we started recording the show this week. I was watching the announcement. I was actually walking Denver and looking at Facebook Live in the news to hear the grand jury's indictment. And then subsequently thereafter, I watched the Kentucky Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, talk about the indictment against Brett Hankerson. And so while these decisions that come from grand juries that are decided routinely now, in the past several years, especially now with social media and getting news in real time, they've left this feeling of being, you know, gutted essentially. While these decisions seemingly are predictable, where a lot of activists and thought leaders say, you know, this is predictable and we knew this was going to happen and we knew all the officers wouldn't be indicted, and we knew that the charges wouldn't be that of murder, that they would be something else. It's nonetheless devastating. It's nonetheless devastating. Each decision that comes, no matter how it's said in a press conference or on a news station, doesn't take away from the fact that a being is gone from this earth, that a family is going to probably not recover emotionally or spiritually because of that loss over their entire lifetime, that financial restitution to families that this happens to do not replace that being that is gone from this world and from their lives. And, you know, there is no way that justice was carried out today. As you said before, these things are still unfolding, but as we sit now on September 23rd, this has broken the hearts of a nation. People of different races, socioeconomic backgrounds, and a lot of times in aspects we hear the news coverage around these things and make it seem like only a small, minute few population are outraged or mad. As a nation, we should all be mad. This was someone sleeping in their home. She was a precious life to those that loved her and knew her, and she is gone. And the outcome from today's announcement doesn't bring solace or comfort in any way. And this is why we continue to say Black Lives Matter, because this nation continuously shows us that they don't.
Absolutely. So listeners, I'll leave you with this. It's become sort of the rallying cry of the movement. It's an Assata Shakur quote from her autobiography. And it's the mantra that we say to remind ourselves that that the fight continues no matter what, and to keep the faith. But as the mantra goes, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And with that, Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Toshiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.